The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
My name is David Vladek. I teach law at that other law school across town, but law professors know why there's these bullet holes up here. I've been asked to moderate this first panel, which is an easy job because you'll hear from five really distinguished, extraordinary lawyers who have spent a lot of their careers, or in some cases, all of their careers, working on these issues. What I plan on doing is introducing the panelists and asking them to start by responding to really the overarching question that we're going to begin with today, which is, what is the current state of our whistleblower protection laws? Then we'll move to a more dynamic question and answer where we'll discuss a number of questions about whistleblower protection. And it's our aim to leave about a half an hour for questions from the audience. And so I'd like you to sort of jot down whatever question you might have. You'll get a chance to ask it towards the end of our session. We're going to do this alphabetically, so starting on my far right, your left, our first speaker will be Tom Devine. Now, Tom is nearing his 30th year at Gap, a feat that's hard to fathom since Tom just celebrated his 40th birthday. Tom has represented or helped literally thousands of whistleblowers, including nuclear power plant workers, meat inspectors, technicians working on advanced weapons technology, and virtually everyone else. Tom has also been active in the policy arena. He's worked for passage of the Whistleblower Protection Act of 1989, statutes giving corporate whistleblowers the right to jury trials, and international efforts to protect whistleblowers. Tom is the author of numerous law review articles, op-ed pieces, and a book entitled Courage with Martyrdom, The Whistleblower's Survivor Guide. Our next speaker will be David Marshall. David is a founding member of one of Washington's premier employment and civil rights firms, Katz, Marshall, and Banks. David has had a fascinating journey on his way to this position. David graduated from Harvard Law School in 1980, worked for several years as a lawyer, but then took over a decade off to work as an industrial worker, first as a steel worker, then in a refinery, finally in the railroad industry. David resumed his legal career in 1997, which we are all grateful for. David's well known for his expertise in representing whistleblowers in the corporate sector, in the government sector, as well as plaintiffs in sexual harassment and other employment and civil rights matters. Sitting next to David is Sean Moulton. Sean is the director of the Federal Information Policy Program at OMB Watch, a position Sean has held for quite some time. Sean is an expert in government information policy and has recently worked to coordinate the environmental community's opposition to the EPA's cutback on the toxic release inventory program. He also helped design one of the truly amazing websites that's available, something called fedspending.org. If you get on this, you can literally track every government contract by contractor, by amount, by date, and by congressional district. Very clever of Sean. Sean will discuss the key role whistleblowers play in bringing to light waste, fraud, and abuse. Following Sean will be Bonnie Robin Vergeer. Bonnie is a former colleague of mine at Public Citizen Litigation Group. I'm the one who laughed. Bonnie has vast experience as a lawyer, having clerked for Judge Stanley Weigel in the Northern District of California, spending time at Zuckerman and Spader and Williams and Connolly, and then working for Senator Biden on the Senate Judiciary Committee. 7 years ago, we were fortunate enough to bring Bonnie to Public Citizen Litigation Group. She's handled a wide range of litigation, including winning, I underscore winning, an important habeas case before the United States Supreme Court, a once-in-a-century feat. More pertinent for today, Bonnie briefed and argued twice, Garcetti versus Sabalos, the key case, the key constitutional case involving whistleblowers. Ultimately, she had to re-argue it because she was so effective the first time, the court had to change its composition in order to rule against her 5-4. But we'll be hearing a lot about Garcetti later on. Last and certainly not least, and not surprisingly, I too am not a fan of proceeding in alphabetical order, is Jason Zuckerman. Jason is also widely respected in the small circle of lawyers handling whistleblower cases. Jason is a principal in the aptly named Employment Law Group and handles lots of cases involving whistleblowers, key TAM cases, civil rights cases, and other employment matters. He's written extensively on whistleblower protection matters and is the co-author of a chapter on whistleblower cases for BNA's treatise, Whistleblowing, the Law of Retaliatory Discharge. Jason has helped draft whistleblower protection laws and works with advocacy groups to enhance whistleblower protection. So we're going to start with Tom, but I will be a fierce timekeeper, so you will get the hook after about 8 or 10 minutes. Tom?
Thanks, David, and it's a real honor to be part of this panel. I'm personally a fan of every one of these folks, so this is neat. I'm also a great believer that all reality is a product of its contradictions, and that's certainly the case about whistleblower law and describing where the dust is settled currently. One reality about these rights is that statutory free speech rights are a fraud whose function is serving as the final nail in the professional coffin of whistleblowers because they rubber stamp retaliation. A second reality is that this is a young civil liberties which is still maturing but currently is a dangerously irresponsible adolescent. The third reality is that this is a phenomenon which is one of the most dynamic in the legal system nationally and internationally. It's a time of great transition for us, but as much as we are changing in terms of the legal system, that's lagging behind the even more dynamic changes involving public opinion. When I first came to Gap, whistleblowers were all viewed as, with a few exceptions, either nuts or traitors. Now we have the scenario where three women whistleblowers are on the cover of Time magazine because they changed the course of history. Whistleblowers are increasingly making a difference, and because the public has recognized that, after the last congressional elections, priorities of the likely voters in the next election were number one, to stop illegal government spending, better fight corruption, 81%. Number two, better protect whistleblowers. That's what the voters expect because the public has woken up that you folks who are here and for the lawyers who defend them are defending the public's eyes and ears. And that leads to the bottom line. This is achieving the potential of whistleblower rights is a challenge that we have to succeed on. The dark ages of the last 7 years illustrate the consequences of abuses of power which are sustained by government secrecy. We have to win this battle, and that's why I'm very excited about this conference, because it can play a significant role. Let's go into the areas where I'm going to give you a little more detail on the state of whistleblower law, which is primarily the federal government law, the Whistleblower Protection Act. To put in perspective the first reality that the laws are a fraud, let's look at the track record of this law. Since Congress made it the strongest free speech law in history on paper in 1994, the track record at the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, which has effectively the final word on appellate review and the only word on appellate review, is 2-201 against whistleblowers for decisions on the merits. Or let's go to the Merit Systems Protection Board, where they get their administrative day in court. Under the current share, the record is 3-2-53 against whistleblowers for final rulings of the MSPB. That's since 2003. At the administrative judge level, where people have their actual day in court, their hearing, for the first 4 months of this year, the track record was 3-62 against whistleblowers in decisions on the merits. You don't have a chance if you actually carry your rights out to a final ruling. The only way that we can successfully defend whistleblowers at GAP is through legal campaigns, like a political campaign. Your rights are a trap in terms of the track record. What are the causes for this? Well, let's start with the immediate causes. And there's two of them. One is loopholes. There are statutory loopholes that are because of the gaps in the law that Congress passed. Examples of that for types of harassment are security clearance retaliation, where somebody can be fired virtually without any explanation of even what the charges against them are, merely a statement that they're not sufficiently trustworthy, loyal to the United States. That takes away their opportunity to see classified documents. It means they're fired through the back door, and they don't have any legal rights. Or the second type of loophole by statute. FBI employees, such as Colleen, if she hadn't resigned, she would have had to argue her rights before the Office of Attorney Recruitment at the FBI. That's where FBI whistleblowers get to go. Or CIA, NSA, intelligence officers, such as the people who wanted to warn us about domestic surveillance but couldn't. Well, then there's the other type of loopholes. These are the ones that weren't created by Congress. They're the product of unrestrained judicial activism by both the administrative and the court level. I'll give you some examples of that. Starting in 1994, Congress said that you are protected for any lawful disclosure of meaningful dissent. That could evidence, that you reasonably believe could evidence of significant government misconduct. In 1995, the decision came down that doesn't include talking to your coworkers. Also in 95, it doesn't include talking to your supervisor, unless the supervisor has direct authority to solve the problem. 1997, predating the First Amendment case that Bonnie's going to talk about, the ruling was that the whistleblower law doesn't apply if it's connected with your job duties, which was supposed to be the point of passing it. Well, then there was a real doozy in 2001 that you don't have whistleblower rights if anyone has raised the problem before you. So much for being a supporting witness, so much for going after ingrained corruption. If you're not the Christopher Columbus of your scandal, you're fresh out of luck. Well, then there's some more. It doesn't count if you blow the whistle in a grievance, which is what many people routinely do. That's what they're most familiar with. Or that it's too trivial. You can blow the whistle on illegality, but if it's trivial illegality, that doesn't count. What are examples of that? Illegal use of immigrant detainees for menial labor, paying contractors for time that they're not working. That's trivial. Not having a suicide watch at the VA hospital, another triviality. Copying confidential patient records at VA hospitals, failing to have any system to protect grand jury information. Or then there's mismanagement and abuse of authority. Well, those don't count unless they're really significant. They've been disposed of as mere negligence. What was mere negligence? Blowing the whistle on the computer security breakdown at the VA, or at the VA system, which led to horrible scandals. Then there's the problem of a loophole because you waited too long to disclose the misconduct. The case that brought this one up involved two border agents. One of them saw the other murder someone crossing the border. The murderer said that if you don't keep your mouth shut, you'll go, I'll take you out too. So the border agent who was a witness slept on this overnight, came in the next day, decided to blow the whistle. The Federal Circuit Court of Appeals said you waited too long. Or if you're blamed for making a disclosure that you didn't make, that doesn't count under the whistleblower laws. In other words, these things are like driving down a road with more potholes than pavement. But if you survive the gauntlet of loopholes, then you're really in trouble because you're going to get a decision that you deserved it. In 1999, the Federal Circuit ruled that the legal standard that you're protected if you disclose information that you reasonably believe is evidence of misconduct requires irrefragable proof. Well, I didn't know what irrefragable meant, you know, but we tracked it down. It means undeniable, incontrovertible, uncontestable, or incapable of being overthrown. In other words, much easier to put somebody in jail than to qualify to prove you're retaliated against. The Federal Circuit changed that ruling after a lot of congressional uproar. So we're not going to have an irrefragable proof standard. But you don't have a reasonable belief if a reasonable person could disagree with you. In other words, a synonym for the uglier word. In this case, the whistleblower's rights were thrown out. Although the Secretary of Air Force agreed with the whistleblower on pork barrel corruption, the Air Force lawyers hired a consultant who disagreed with the whistleblower, and that was enough to mean that he didn't have free speech rights. The cause of this breakdown is really a double Achilles heel, from lowest common denominator due process. At the board level for fact-finding and at the appellate level with the Federal Circuit for matters of law. And it's not new. The reason we passed the Whistleblower Protection Act is only four people had won in the first decade of the law. Now it's two people have won in the last 5 years. The reason we passed expanded rights is the Federal Circuit in the 80s was saying, you don't have any rights if somebody has raised these issues before. Congress rewrote the law. They're making the same decisions. The good news from this rather pessimistic diagnosis is the times are changing. After 8.5 years, we've got legislation into the conference committee, which will give normal access to appellate courts, which will give people jury trials to enforce their rights, and will close the loopholes for any form of harassment against anyone who is paid by the taxpayers. This is a very significant struggle. We're in the end game of it now. It's going to be resolved over the next month. And this conference is an opportunity for you to join this effort. You'll see materials in the handout packets. Come and talk to me. I'd love to work with you. Thanks.
Thank you, John.
Follow. Tom really is, even though he's only a 40-year-old dean, he's the dean of whistleblowing knowledge, I think, in D.C. And nationally. And everybody who practices in this area very much looks up to Tom for what he's contributed over the years. And now he's really spearheading this first opportunity that we've had in years to push forward with whistleblower protections in a way that really hasn't been open for some years now, at least during the current administration. I want to thank GAP for inviting me to speak at this very important conference. I think, as others have said, the public perception of whistleblowers today is what is driving the opening of opportunities to advance protections for workers throughout society who stand up, risk all, especially their careers, to speak out about wrongdoing on behalf of their employers and others whom they're involved with. And I think the public increasingly recognizes that with all of the secrecy that shrouds the wrongdoing of corporations, which is just endless, in my opinion, just about every transaction that you get involved in with a big company is going to involve some type of fraud. At least that's my experience as a consumer and as a worker, and I think that's most everybody else's as well. But I think the public recognizes increasingly that the only, or rather the most reliable source of information about wrongdoing in these companies and in government are the rank and file and mid-level managers and workers who are asked to participate in wrongdoing, in waste, fraud, abuse, in gross, horrific and frightening violations of safety standards in the airline industry and nuclear power plants and transportation, in other industries and other activities that we take for granted when we get on trains and get on airplanes and so on, that the recognition that that the average worker who stands up and speaks out is deserving of protection, and not only that that worker is deserving of protection, but that if protection is not granted to those employees, protection against firing and other forms of retaliation, then we, the public, are at risk every time we leave our homes. The whistleblower laws in the U.S. are very, you know, varied and multiple. There are a lot of very good state laws. My firm brings a lot of actions on behalf of whistleblowers who are protected by different doctrines of exceptions to at-will employment, doctrines that prohibit terminations in violation of the public policies that underlie state and federal laws. And many states have these protections to one extent or another. There are some very good ones. And those laws are actually some of the very best whistleblower laws in this society, although many of them are not written except through the evolution of court decisions. There are a number of federal laws that protect private sector workers. Tom went over what protects or doesn't protect, in fact, federal sector workers who blow the whistle on wrongdoing. But I want to speak some about the backsliding or rightward march in the degradation of the protections of mainly private sector employees who should be protected by laws that are on the books, federal laws that are administered by the Department of Labor, anti-retaliation provisions in the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Energy Reorganization Act, which governs nuclear power plants and other licensees that of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. There are a dozen or more such laws that are administered by the Department of Labor, including the new Sarbanes-Oxley law that is passed in 2002, relatively new, that governs and attempts to prevent fraud in and by publicly traded companies on shareholders. The new Sarbanes-Oxley law has what on paper is a very strong anti-retaliation provision that protects an employee of a publicly traded company against retaliation for complaining either internally or externally about a wide range of activity that amounts to various kinds of fraud, not only on shareholders, but as the statute is as you read it, it would prohibit retaliation against an employee who's complained about what some have called just garden variety fraud. Every time you buy a car, there is wire fraud involved in that transaction, I think, for anybody who's been through that experience. And the Sarbanes-Oxley law, as written, would protect employees who complain about publicly traded companies defrauding customers, clients, and others, especially shareholders. But so what I want to focus on just briefly is some of what's happened in the Department of Labor jurisprudence and treatment of whistleblower cases. These laws cover a wide segment of society because there are many workers that are involved in the industries that are covered by the environmental whistleblower laws, and then many, many more who work for publicly traded companies or their agents who have spoken out about shareholder fraud and other financial wrongdoing. To put it very bluntly and briefly, what has happened over the past 8 or so years is that the Department of Labor has gone from being an agency which, to some extent, unevenly, but to some extent protected the rights of workers on the job to speak out about safety violations and so on, to an agency that every step of the way, from what I can tell practicing before them during this entire period, is determined to dismiss every single case that it can. These cases begin with a complaint that's filed by an employee. They're then investigated by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. The employee who loses there, as almost every employee does, can then request a hearing before a Department of Labor administrative judge, where increasingly employees lose. But there are still some good decisions coming out of these lower-level judges. But then when the employee appeals to the Administrative Review Board, I don't know what the current statistics are. Every time somebody compiles them, I think Jason has and others have, Tom's holding up a zero. With the Sarbanes-Oxley complaints, ever since employees started filing them in 2002, the score is about employers 1,000, employees zero. That is, I believe that no single case has been won if it went all the way through adjudication that was brought by an employee under the Sarbanes-Oxley whistleblower protections. And in fact, it's been in the Sarbanes-Oxley arena that a lot of the cutting back on the rights of employees throughout society who complain about wrongdoing and safety issues and so on is being where those that contraction is taking place. One of the interesting things about the way that this has gone, just turned topsy-turvy, is that the Administrative Review Board of the Department of Labor and the Circuit Courts of Appeals, which hear appeals from its decisions, have long said that because of the similarity in these laws, their whistleblower protections being generated from the Mine Safety and Health Act and other laws and having a lot of similarities, that the case law generated under one law can be used in informing decisions under other laws. And so that led to a lot of very good decisions over the years, in the 90s mainly, that protected workers. Well, now, faced with a new law, the Sarbanes-Oxley law, which is very broad, gives broad protections to a lot of workers throughout many industries, the Administrative Review Board and the Circuit Courts of Appeals have narrowed the rights of workers just dramatically under that law, so that if you read the Sarbanes-Oxley anti-retaliation provision, which I think Jason might speak more about, he's probably the leading expert in the country on it, if you read the provision and then you look at the decisions, you can't believe that the courts are actually adjudicating cases under the provision that you're reading. For instance, the Sarbanes-Oxley law purports to protect an employee of a publicly traded company from retaliation for complaining about mail fraud or wire fraud. The courts and the ARB have increasingly found that the employee is only protected if the employee is complaining about fraud on shareholders or violations of SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, rules and regulations. It really has nothing to do with the way that the statute's written, but I think that the right wing, which is, I think, very well represented in the ARB and on the courts of appeals that have dealt with these issues, have concluded that regardless of what Congress passed in the wake of the Enron and MCI scandals and other accounting scandals, that workers in this society simply cannot be protected against such a broad range of whistleblowing on wrongdoing. And I think that the opportunity that we have now that this conference addresses is how to move forward with whistleblower protections for workers and employees throughout society. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much for having me. In the interest of full disclosure, I should point out that I am, I think, the only non-lawyer on the panel. Thank you. I'm really coming at this from more of a, I'm a simple policy wonk. I work on transparency and government accountability. And in that sense, when I think of whistleblowers and the current status of their protection, I can't help but equate them to a natural resource of the country that is being woefully squandered under the current policies. They come to government and policy with the idea that honesty and integrity, effectiveness, are things that should be in place. And when you think about it, in a lot of ways, most of our government activity right now is an attempt to get people simply to do the right thing, to act ethically, to act responsibly, whether it's environmental laws and regulations trying to make sure that the water is kept clean and the air is kept clean, that species aren't driven to extinction, or contractor laws that make sure that taxpayer money isn't frivolously spent or given out to your brother's contracting company. The whole effort of government is really to make sure that the society operates effectively and with some responsibility. But even with all these laws and regulations in place, we all know that doesn't always work. For all our mechanisms for accountability, for transparency, we encounter some very significant problems, whether it's intentional, whether it's fraud, or if it's simple mismanagement, botching of the job, and then a cover-up to avoid the embarrassment, to avoid the responsibility. And that's when whistleblowers step in as sort of our last line of defense to say that there still needs to be accountability for these things. They can't be simply swept under the carpet. Because if that occurs, then there is no lesson learned. And it may be a painful lesson often for agencies and for public officials to learn. They're embarrassing when an agency has lost $1 billion or has mismanaged their resources or their responsibilities in such a way that there's something so newsworthy about it that it makes it onto the cover of Time magazine. But the reality is we need that. Just like sort of critical editing for a piece someone might write, it doesn't always feel good to get a piece back and have that red marker all over the paper, but in the end, the piece is better. Unfortunately, government has too much an ability right now to avoid that editing process. It has the ability to set its own rules and set the agenda. And when someone does have the courage to step forward and saying, you're not even accomplishing what you're supposed to be accomplishing, whether it's the war on terror, whether it's global warming, whatever the topic is, people step forward and say, you're not moving forward in a responsible manner. You're not being honest with people. And that should change. Unfortunately, as we've seen, their ability to sort of game the system and set the rules also takes effect when it comes to whistleblowers. And I was really struck by Tom's list of all the different reasons that these things get thrown out, whether it's you're not the first to blow the whistle on something or something is not serious enough from the government's perspective. When people hear this, I have to say, their jaws really do drop. I mean, they drop about the mismanagement that the government could botch something so obviously. But then they also drop when they find out how poorly these whistleblowers are treated. Because I think in the movie version at home that they're watching, those whistleblowers wind up getting promotions. The supervisor who spent the money on his brother's company or whatever, they get fired. They get fired, the person gets promoted, and there's a happy Hollywood ending. And the reality is that's not often the case. Often the case is that the government, in an effort to sort of cover its own tail, will protect the wrongdoer in order to avoid the accountability of trying to fix that wrongdoing or prevent that wrongdoing in the future. Because that's the hard thing. The easy thing to do is to protect the upper management, protect the wrongdoer, and to label the whistleblower the troublemaker, the outsider, the instigator, and push them out. Unfortunately, that leaves us in a rather indelicate position of having a government that simply does not want to, nor does it have to act responsibly. That may, and I hope will change. We've had Congress move forward on this time and again in a very unanimous fashion, a very strong fashion to say whistleblowers are very important to government. And yet we've seen the administration chip away at whistleblower protections and mismanage efforts to protect them. I mean, this administration, I have to say, is not the one, given its track record on other areas of accountability and transparency, that I would expect much improvement from. But we've also seen the courts chipping away at whistleblowers with some pretty irresponsible and almost unfathomable decisions. When you tell people out away from D.C., they find it hard to believe that these kinds of standards are set, that you can't blow the whistle on something somebody else had blown the whistle on 10 years ago. Or if it's a grievance, you can't blow the whistle on it. It just doesn't make any sense. And people think government should make sense. It's our hope, OMB Watch's hope, that with a new law and a new administration, which either one that's coming in couldn't be worse than this one, we hope, we can really start moving forward into something where whistleblowers are recognized for the progress they represent for our government. It's not always, as I said, a comfortable progress, but it's an important one. And we think that, it represents something for our country that we've long stood for in terms of honesty, integrity in our government. Thank you.
Thank you very much for inviting me to speak. The last few speakers have been focusing on statutory free speech rights. I want to talk for a moment about the status of First Amendment free speech rights, which suffered a severe blow after the Supreme Court decided Garcetti versus Ceballos, which I had as David referred to, I had the, I don't know if you want to say, good fortune to argue twice before the Supreme Court before losing it ultimately 5-4 after Justice Alito replaced Justice O'Connor on the court. Going back for a moment to the time before the 1960s, there was no recognized First Amendment free speech right for public employees. The classic view of this was expressed by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, and this is off-quoted, but a policeman may have a constitutional right to talk politics, but he has no constitutional right to be a policeman. And that was the view that prevailed in the courts until the 1960s. The Watershed case, which recognized that public employees do not relinquish their free speech rights when they accept public employment, was Pickering versus Board of Education, decided in 1968. And that case arose in the context of a public school teacher who wrote a letter to the editor that the school board did not appreciate. And out of that case came what's been known as the Pickering balancing test. The court, when a public employee speaks up, and the employer takes adverse action against them, the court balances or weighs the importance of the employee's speech as opposed to the employer's interest in avoiding disruption, lack of efficiency in the workplace, and so on. And that's the test that's prevailed ever since 1968. After that, new hurdles were gradually added for the public employee. There's a Mount Healthy causation test. The employee has to show that his or her speech was actually the motivating factor for the employer's decision to take an adverse action, and the employer has the option to come back and show by preponderance of the evidence that the employer would have done whatever it did to the employee regardless. You know, the employer comes back and proves, well, the employee's late every day, and that's why we fired the employee, not because he spoke up about the fact that we're corrupt and mismanaging public resources and the like. In 1983, Connick versus Myers was decided, and that's when the public concern test was added. Public employees only enjoyed First Amendment protection in the workplace if their speech touched on a topic of public concern, and that was occasionally a difficult hurdle for public employees if their grievance was viewed as more of an internal gripe about personnel matters as opposed to something that was sort of newsworthy and of general community interest, then they didn't get past that threshold and they lost their case. But the courts did not focus on the capacity in which a public employee spoke until around the 1990s. That issue started to be litigated more and more in the lower courts. The question was the public employee speaking as a citizen or speaking as a public employee? And I think as probably a lot of people in the room might appreciate, that's not necessarily a black and white type of issue where you're speaking one way or the other way. Oftentimes, public employees are motivated both by a general concern, they want to come forward and expose government misconduct, wrongdoing, and that, in a sense, that's a motivation as a citizen. But at the same time, they're learning about whatever they've learned. Their information arose in the context of them doing their jobs. So that issue began to be litigated in the 1990s, and the majority view in the courts was that if a public employee was blowing the whistle on an issue of public concern, especially if it dealt with government misconduct, gross mismanagement, corruption, and the like, then the employee was speaking more as a citizen than as a public employee, regardless of whether technically the employee was doing his or her job at the time. And that was really the majority view until the Supreme Court granted cert in Garcetti versus Ceballos. That case arose in I, as a lawyer at Public Citizen, became involved at the cert stage of that case, and I was not involved in litigating it in the Ninth Circuit or the district court. Richard Ceballos was a prosecutor in Los Angeles County. He was a line prosecutor with supervisory responsibilities. Defense counsel came up to him in a case in which he had supervisory authority and asked him if he would look into, there was a criminal case pending, and he asked him to investigate the search warrant. He thought it was based on falsified information in the police affidavit. And Mr. Ceballos agreed to look into that. He reviewed the file. He investigated at the scene. And he concluded that yes, the police had lied in preparing the affidavit that was the basis for the search warrant. He actually talked about this issue in his office before it ever got to the point of a memo. But the case has come to focus on the memo that he wrote. And he wrote a memo to his supervisors that explained the situation, disclosed what he believed to be the police misconduct, recommended dismissal of the case on that ground, and gave that to his supervisors. And after a little mini outcry from the sheriff's office, which did not appreciate what he'd said, he ultimately suffered several different kinds of retaliation in the workplace. He wasn't fired, but he was transferred and demoted and suffered various reprisals. And so the case, as it came to the Supreme Court, presented the question of whether when a public employee is speaking pursuant to his or her official job duties, does that person still enjoy First Amendment protection for their speech? And this is assuming that the speech is on a matter of public concern, which it was. And the Supreme Court ultimately held no, and drew pretty much a line and created a per se rule that if the speech by the public employee was pursuant to his or her job duties, then that person enjoys no First Amendment protection. If it was not part of their job duties, then you've just cleared that hurdle and you go on to the rest of the Pickering-Connick test that already existed. So what we've got is this new threshold test. The public employee has to be speaking up as a citizen. And the passage that's led to all litigation, and I have to say, I think maybe they just didn't believe me, but I argued to the court that if they created this per se line, there was going to be a huge amount of litigation over the question of what counted as speech pursuant to job duties. It's often not a black and white question where you just, look at the job description and say, yes, that's part of their job duties or not. There's quite a lot of gray area here. When you're performing your job and something comes up, but you take action that would not ordinarily be considered part of your job to do, what do you do with those kinds of cases? And the passage in Garcetti that's generated the most litigation, I'm just going to read this one passage to you. The parties in the case do not dispute that Ceballos wrote his disposition memo pursuant to his employment duties. We thus have no occasion to articulate a comprehensive framework for defining the scope of an employee's duties in cases where there is room for serious debate. We reject, however, the suggestion that employers can restrict employees' rights by creating excessively broad job descriptions. The proper inquiry is a practical one. Formal job descriptions often bear little resemblance to the duties an employee actually is expected to perform, and the listing of a given task in an employee's written job description is neither necessary nor sufficient to demonstrate that conducting the task is within the scope of the employee's professional duties for First Amendment purposes. So that sort of leaves the court with, okay, now what? There's no framework, so we're going to bluff. And I just want to give you just a really quick snapshot of what's happened. In the first year after Garcetti was decided, things weren't so bad in the district court. About 50% of the plaintiffs were surviving defense-based Garcetti motions. The district courts were closer to the facts. I think they seemed a little more outraged about some of the things that were happening to the public employees, and they took a very nitpicky view about what counted as speech pursuant to job duty. Even though it came up during the course of the employee's performance of the job, the district court might say, well, employees aren't expected to tell that their colleagues are engaged in the police force or engaging in, you know, excessive force or police abuse. That's not part of the job. So the plaintiffs were clearing this hurdle about half the time in the district courts. Now in year two, a lot of court of appeals have been deciding the cases now that have now come up through the district courts, and things are just awful. I mean, there's no good spin I can put on this, and especially you do not want to be in the Seventh Circuit or the 11th Circuit at all. The courts are giving a very broad view to what counts as speech pursuant to the job duties. It's not this more technical view that the district courts are trying to impose. If it's a task that was performed sort of in the course of the employee's performance of the job, the Court of Appeals are, for the most part, are saying that counts as speech according pursuant to official job duties, even if it's just merely related to the job and not something you might expect the employee to perform. And it's now moved into a place where speech that you would have thought was off limits, not subject to the Garcetti limitation, going public, going to a newspaper, going to television stations, even those cases are now slowly being encroached upon, where the courts are saying it's an outgrowth of the employee speech. Let me just give you a quick example. This case seems so outrageous that I prepared an amicus brief, and it was submitted on behalf of Public Citizen, GAP, NELA, ACLU of Maryland, and the Reporters Committee. This is a case coming out of the district court in Maryland, Andrew versus Clark, where a police commander in Baltimore who did not have direct supervisory situation over a particular scenario that occurred, but basically there was a barricade situation. Somebody was locked up inside their apartment, and the police had ringed the place, and eventually somebody went in, and they gave the order, and the person inside was shot and killed. And the police commander thought the situation had been botched, that there were nonviolent ways they could have dealt with this without it reaching the point that it had. So he wrote a memo to the chief of police of Baltimore outlining what he thought had gone wrong. And they weren't taking him seriously. No one was reacting or doing anything he suggested. So he took his memo to the Baltimore Sun, which then published an article about what he had said, and then a follow-up article. And he was demoted, and he lost his command position. And the district court took the view that his memo, and what he claimed his complaint was not that they retaliated against him because of the memo, but because he went to the Baltimore Sun with the memo. And what the district court said is, well, he wrote the memo pursuant to his job duties. He's a police commander. That's the sort of thing a police commander would be expected to do. And just because he takes it to the press doesn't transform it into a different kind of speech than what it is. It is what it is. It's employee speech, so it doesn't really matter where he takes it. Basically, the bottom line is that once something comes up within the course of your employment, there's nothing you can do. You can't even speak publicly about it to try to get out from under this new hurdle. And so we'll have to see what happens to that case in the Fourth Circuit. And anyway, hopefully states and the federal government will pass stronger statutory protections so that plaintiffs won't feel like they don't have recourse other than the First Amendment, because that's not a fruitful area of litigation at this point.
Hi, thank you again for having me today. It really is an honor to be on this panel and at this conference. I want to talk about six obstacles that my clients often encounter, and I represent a lot of individuals who blow the whistle in the private sector. I want to begin with one that we heard earlier about from Mark Cohen, which is judicial activism. For those who may not know, a so-called conservative judge will look at the plain and ordinary meaning of a law and apply it, and won't invent law, won't try to expand the law, won't try to narrow law, will apply plain, ordinary meaning. I have never seen a clear example of judges rewriting a law than under the anti-retaliation provision of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which is now about 6 years old. I'll give you three examples of that. And by the way, it was largely created by this organization, by the Government Accountability Project. When it went through, it looked like a great law. Right now, I think it is very, very weak because it has been rewritten. First, the law explicitly provides that it applies to a publicly traded company or to any employee, contractor, subcontractor, or agent of such company. For example, an employee at a law firm or at an accounting firm who blows the whistle on their client's violation of an SEC rule should have a claim if there is retaliation. The ARB at DOL has rewritten part of this out of existence so that it only applies to an actual employee of a publicly traded company. Number two, the range of protected conduct. Under the plain and ordinary meaning of this act, an individual blows the whistle if they raise a concern about a violation of any rule or regulation of the SEC, or, and the key is the word or appears here, and it's an independent clause, any provision of law relating to fraud against shareholders. Those are two independent clauses, two ways in which an employee can engage in protected conduct. Well, we just got a ruling out of the Fourth Circuit in a case in which the client was actually represented by the Government Accountability Project, in which the court conflates those two and says you can engage in protected conduct if you raise a concern about a violation of an SEC rule only if it relates to fraud against shareholders. That is rewriting the law, and it has a real consequence because it significantly narrows the range of protected conduct under SOX. There are a host of SEC rules that are designed to prevent fraud. For example, when my clients raise a concern about inadequate internal accounting controls, that can prevent shareholder fraud from happening. But somehow, these two judges on the Fourth Circuit believe it is within their authority or prerogative to rewrite this law. That is judicial activism, and I believe If a judge wants to rewrite a law, he or she should run for public office. Number three, to take off on what was talked about by the last speaker, this absurd concept that if you blow the whistle in the course of performing your job responsibilities, you haven't engaged in protected conduct. Nowhere does that appear in Sarbanes-Oxley. It doesn't say that you engage in protected conduct only if you go beyond your normal job responsibilities. But that argument has been made. The Supreme Court's holding in the Garcetti case says we are applying it only in the context of claims that are brought under Section 1983. But employers make this argument. I had a client who's an in-house counsel. She blew the whistle. The employer's main argument was Her job is to blow the whistle. That's what we pay her to do. How could she possibly have engaged in protected conduct? Well, I came back with a following argument, which the judge bought, which is that's exactly what this law is for. When we had Enron, when we had WorldCom, Congress realized that that in-house counsel was asleep at the wheel. They knew about these violations, and they didn't do anything about it. Why? Because they knew that their jobs could be at risk if they blew the whistle. This law is designed to encourage in-house accountants and in-house counsel to blow the whistle when they become aware of violations. Well, I was successful with my client. There are a few judges who are applying this absurd concept. There's a great opinion out of the Ninth Circuit that rejects this idea in the context of workers at nuclear power plants. A quality assurance inspector at a nuclear plant is paid to go out through the plant and to find violations of NRC rules. That's his job. He may be engaging in protected conduct every day, but if he blows the whistle on a violation and there's some adverse employment action, well, lo and behold, he's probably not going to blow the whistle again when he's aware of a violation. Well, we in the public want quality assurance inspectors at nuclear plants to blow the whistle on violations. That's how we and the NRC ensure that those plants operate in a safe way. So this concept that comes out of the Garcetti case should not be applied anywhere else. And if you look at any of the laws that have been written by the Government Accountability Project in the past year, they're very proactive on it. They make sure to make it clear that an employee can engage in protected conduct in the course of performing his or her job responsibilities. To get back to what was said earlier, the agencies that are responsible for the enforcement of these laws have been asleep at the wheel and are hostile to a lot of my clients. I think 98% of all of the whistleblower claims at OSHA go for the employer. There's a new policy at OSHA that blows me away. When my client brings a complaint, the employer can submit an answer. It's not a paragraph-by-paragraph response. It just provides their general response to the complaint. Well, I don't get a copy of it. The employer gets a copy of the complaint, but I don't get a copy of the answer, so I can't even see all the absurd allegations that can be made against my client. I can see it if I enter into a confidentiality order, which I'm damned if I do. I'm not going to be complicit in protecting the employer's violation of law. It should come to light. That's why I bring these claims. It's an absurd policy. How am I supposed to be able to prosecute my client's claim if I don't even know what allegations are being made against my client? The utter failure of OSHA to enforce these laws in the past 8 years has consequences. There have been major accidents at a lot of the coal mines. They're not really accidents because they could have been prevented if those coal mining companies were complying with the law. Well, after each of these incidents occurred, there was a congressional investigation, and lo and behold, they found each time that employees knew of these violations and felt that if they blew the whistle, they'd lose their jobs. And my point here is that OSHA's utter failure to enforce these laws has consequences. There are lives lost. These are important laws. They protect the general public. They don't just protect my clients, and therefore there needs to be some significant change at the Department of Labor. I'll give you another example. The client who blew the whistle about a contractor of the Department of Defense who was providing defective equipment to our military personnel in Iraq. My client brings a claim. Shortly after the claim is brought, the contractor comes up with a policy prohibiting employees from sharing any documents with any government agency. So I call the main counsel for the Department of Defense Office of Inspector General and say, here's this policy. Aren't you concerned about this? Why should any contractor be allowed to have a government contract when they prohibit employees from reporting fraud to the U.S. government? And the DODIG did not give a damn. She said, well, you know, it's not clearly a violation of law. We're we're not planning to do anything about it. So often, I find that the very agencies that are responsible for oversight are complicit with the contractors and are more concerned with protecting these contractors than protecting the employees, often my clients, who have blown the whistle. If I could go into one more area that's been a major obstacle. Many of these laws, including Sarbanes-Oxley, require that the employee only have a reasonable belief in the concern about a violation of law that the employee brought up. Well, two recent opinions out of the Fourth Circuit and out of the Fifth Circuit apply such a high standard of objective reasonableness that almost no individual can meet it if he or she is not a securities lawyer. And what do I mean by that? In one case, which is known as the Allen case, the employee was a CPA, blew the whistle on inaccurate information in the company's financial statements. Now, those financial statements had not yet actually been submitted to the SEC. She was retaliated against when she blew the whistle. Well, under the holding of the Fifth Circuit, they say, well, because she's a licensed CPA, she's a per se accounting expert, and therefore she should have known that this rule technically applies only when the financial statements have been brought before the SEC. Well, as a policy matter, this is absurd. An employee should be able to blow the whistle before there's been actual shareholder fraud. That's what we want employees to do. But more importantly, how many people here are right out of law school? Show of hands. Okay. Well, once you get into the bar, according to the Fifth Circuit, you're a legal expert. It's an absurd idea. But when the courts hold people to a high to the point that they have to be able to show an actual violation of law in order to prove that they engaged in protected conduct, almost none of these claims will actually get to a trial, and my clients don't have a chance at all. So these are a few of the points I wanted to make, and I hope what will be the impact of this conference is that we will all work very, very hard to see that these laws can be significantly improved as soon as possible because they have been substantially undermined. Thank you very much.
So we've heard the constraints on public employee whistleblowers. We've heard the limitations on the protections for public sector, private sector whistleblowers. So I'd like to get the panel to answer this question. Who's better off, given the paltry protections on both sides of the ledger? Who's better off, corporate whistleblowers or federal sector whistleblowers? And Tom, why don't you start us off on that?
I'd say the corporate whistleblowers are clearly better off because they don't have as many rights that are frauds.
David?
Well,
How do you follow up on that?
Wait, that's true. I mean, I think that the public sector whistleblowers, certainly in the federal government, as Tom described under the Whistleblower Protection Act, really effectively have almost no rights. If you look at the Office of Special Counsel, the circus that is the Office of Special Counsel that hears these matters, it's incredibly hostile to employees and incredibly involved in just an orgy of self-serving fraud and corruption. So how it can be effective in its mission, you know, is just impossible. But in the private sector, I guess what's shocking is just to watch the erosion of rights. The point that the last speaker, that Jason, made about these judicial activist decisions, the one out of the Fourth Circuit also holds that, well, it's the same as the Allen decision in the Fifth Circuit. In Livingston, the Fourth Circuit decision that Jason mentioned earlier, it's really just an incredible list of a couple of dozen minutia that in dicta that cut away at the rights of whistleblowers. And one of the points there is that the guy who was the plaintiff who was blowing the whistle on noncompliance with a consent decree with the FDA that would likely result in some $30 million in fines and should be reported to shareholders. What happened was that the court ruled that he had not engaged in protected activity when he raised these issues because the event had not actually happened yet. They hadn't actually violated the consent decree and actually hadn't reported it to shareholders incorrectly. So the real effect of that is, for instance, in the railroad industry, there are new whistleblower protections that look great on paper. That is, a rail worker in a rail yard can complain about safety violations, and these involve all kinds of things, chlorine gas, nuclear materials, everything that moves in transit in this country. And if he says to his boss, boss, you know, if we don't fix that switch that's going to direct the train in this direction, the 4:30 that's going to arrive in an hour, it's going to go right through the station and kill, you know, 500 people. They can say, you're fired for raising that. Then they fix the problem. And then under the ARB decisions and the Fourth Circuit decision in Livingston, and I believe this Fifth Circuit decision, the whistleblower would not be protected because he's complaining about a speculative event, complaining speculatively. It hadn't happened. They fired him. They fixed it. And he's out the door. It really completely eviscerates whistleblower protections. And I think in the private sector, it's really getting more and more that way. And that's that particular issue is a very big one because so many people that you represent blew the whistle on something before it happened. They went to their boss and they said, we got to stop this. If we don't stop it, we're going to be in violation of the law. We're going to be defrauding shareholders. We're going to melt down and blow up the state of Alabama with our nuclear plant. Any issue like that, they can fire them, fix the problem, and then the next person is not going to come forward. It's very simple and very clear. And I think that is the current direction, at least in the decision. So it's hard to say. I think everybody's pretty well screwed by the direction of things, and we really need reform for that reason.
Anyone else want to chime in, Jason?
I'll add very quickly. I think from a purely legal perspective, workers in the public sector have more options. That being said, there is a lot I like about certain claims that I prosecute in the private sector. And that is, when I get these claims, I don't just look at them under the law. I look at them holistically. I say, what is at stake for the employer? Bring a lot of claims for retaliation under the False Claims Act. I ask myself, would the employer want its employees to go under oath and to admit to violations of the False Claims Act? How would the employer feel if these allegations were to come to light? How would, and I also do a lot of work for employees at various nuclear power plants, how would the employer feel if the NRC were to look into whether there have been violations of certain NRC rules? So what I'm able to do sometimes is resolve these claims early on before a complaint has ever been brought. I would say that when I'm bringing a claim on behalf of an employee of the government, I don't really think about it that way because they often don't care if these allegations come to light. They don't want to resolve it early. They're planning to go all the way to trial. But in the private sector, I think there are sometimes more options to resolve these claims earlier, and the employer sometimes has a lot at stake. So I think in some ways employees in the private sector have a little bit more leverage than employees in the public sector, not under the law, but more in a practical sense.
All right. Well, Tom, you want the last word on this?
To put an exclamation point on David's insight. Whistleblowing to serve the purposes of accountability is very important. That's how we hold people responsible for their abuses of power. But it's not in the same league as the freedom to warn. That's how we prevent the avoidable disasters, before it's too late for anything except picking up the pieces and scapegoat whose fault it was. Under the recent decisions on Sarbanes-Oxley, you have to not only wait for the fait accompli to be completed, then there has to be severe consequences from it. The government has to decide to enforce the law, and the enforcement penalties have to actually lower the value of the shareholders' investment. This is totally outrageous. It means that we've stripped away the primary benefit of whistleblower laws, which is to prevent unnecessary tragedies. And that in itself is a tragedy.
Well, talking about tragedies, I'd like to ask Bonnie a question about Garcetti. Assume for the moment there was a new Supreme Court. We're going to have a new president, not soon enough, but by next February. And there are many elderly members of the court. Suppose that the gods smile on us and we have a new, more receptive court. Are there opportunities under Garcetti to argue to the court that they ought to change this unworkable standard that has proven so hostile to whistleblowers?
Well, I think the history of what's happened the last 2 years is one good argument for getting rid of Garcetti, because you have complete arbitrary line drawing based on job descriptions and expectations. You testify before a legislative committee, and depending on whether your testimony is in the ballpark of relating to your job, as opposed to you're complaining about the sunshine laws and your job is actually sewage, then we're going to protect what you said. So concrete examples is one good way, I think, of pointing it out, but probably 2 years of experience isn't long enough in terms of convincing the court. Also, an approach might depend on whether Justice Kennedy is still on the court or not. We thought that he might have been gettable as a vote, and he ultimately was not, but he has some concern in terms of professional ethics and so on, that there might be some different way to slant the case somewhat to appeal to concerns that he might have that he wasn't satisfied with in the first go-round. There's also concern, I mean, it really depends, I'm sorry, I don't mean to fight the hypothetical, but it depends who's left the court. I mean, Justice Breyer, we had his vote, but he wrote a concurrence that basically suggested that he would rule for Richard Ceballos and maybe no other public employee, because the focus of his concurrence was on whether there was some other constitutional right that was at stake, because Ceballos was a prosecutor and there were Brady issues and the rights of the criminal defendant, he would have sided with him. But of course, that's not the scenario for many public employees. There isn't some other constitutional right at stake. And so the case would have to be pitched, keeping in mind how do you keep Justice Breyer's vote in some other context. I don't know if that answers your question. I'm not sure if that answers your question. There's no one magic bullet. I'd say, well, if you just argued this, then clearly you'd have a victory. I think uphill battle at the Supreme Court for some years to come.
I'd like to shift gears for a moment and ask Sean a question. Sean has a lot of expertise with the EPA. Does the lack of whistleblower protection, meaningful whistleblower protection, have an impact on EPA's enforcement abilities? What does it do to what is the consequence in terms of the agency's ability to do its job, and most importantly, in terms of the agency's ability to protect the public when whistleblowers are chilled from reporting violations of law?
Well, I think it definitely has a real effect on how well the agency does its job, especially when you get into the fact that when it comes to something like environmental enforcement, there are forces inside EPA currently that don't want the agency to do a very good job. And whistleblowers, if they were more protected, could come forward and talk more aggressively about that and try and hold the agency to a higher standard, a standard that most of the public would say is the true responsibility of the agency. Unfortunately, when political appointees know that, nobody's watching, no one's going to get the memos that they're sending around because they're deliberative or their attorney-client privilege, and no employee is going to come out and blow the whistle because they won't be protected, then they feel more empowered and more emboldened to do more, or in the case of enforcement, actually do less. Fewer inspections, fewer violation notices of violations, fewer efforts to get companies to clean up their act.
Okay, so you've been talking about internal EPA whistleblowers and their inability to discipline the agency to do its work. But how about corporate whistleblowing? We've heard from David, from Jason, that corporate whistleblowers don't feel well protected either. To what extent does the EPA depend on corporate officers blowing the whistle on their own company to detect things like midnight dumping or emissions that are not allowable, other forms of violations of the environmental laws?
Historically, it has been a very welcomed source of information for inspectors and enforcement officials inside EPA. More recently, I think inside EPA, they view it with more skepticism. Their current approach has been one of this idea that we have to approach it with the objectivity of data quality, the idea that we don't know how effective we're being if we are taking some lead from someone else and then inspecting on that and saying, look, we found a big polluter. What we should do is take a random sampling and simply inspect every year and see how well we do, because that would be more objective and we would have a more statistical number in terms of how many people we catch each time. But as any law enforcement personnel would tell you, you don't approach enforcement from a statistical perspective. You approach it from how am I going to catch the bad guys? And certainly leads and leaks were a major way that a lot of the big ones were caught years ago.
Well, let me build on this by asking what I think is the question that Tom, David, and Jason, and probably Bonnie get asked almost every day. You get a telephone call from someone who won't give you their name. They work for a large corporation. They believe their corporation is dumping chemicals they're not supposed to. They want to blow the whistle, but they don't want to lose their job. These are private sector employees. They want to call the EPA and tell them what's going on, but they're worried. They've got a family to support. They've worked at this company for a long time. What advice do you give them? Tom, you've gotten these calls.
Well, that's just a wonderful cue to pitch GAP's upcoming publication. It's called Committing.
I didn't even know about that. So.
Committing the Truth, a Corporate Whistleblower's Survival Handbook. And actually, the legal rights chapter from that is in your handout materials for community comment. What we usually advise whistleblowers to do is not to rely on their rights, but to figure out a way to launder the truth until they can reach the high ground of solidarity.
It's almost Nixonian, launder the truth. Explain what you mean by that.
Unfortunately, that's the facts of life. It's like Ernie Fitzgerald came up with the phrase committing the truth, because you're treated like you committed a crime. And what we do at GAP is try to get the information. We're lawyers, but we're also information matchmakers. And the magic word for us is solidarity. So while there's usually a lawsuit in the mix, the idea is to play information matchmaker with all the people in society who should be benefiting from the isolated whistleblower's knowledge. And when that happens, then we've achieved solidarity. Instead of a corrupt bureaucracy surrounding an isolated whistleblower, it's society surrounding the corrupt bureaucracy. And that's when the house of cards collapses and when you can settle the lawsuit despite having the weak rights. So we work with people to develop an effective legal campaign.
Well, that's all very interesting. David, do you have any more concrete advice other than solidarity? And
well, I mean, I think that's the right approach, and that's the approach that we use in almost all of our cases too. But you know, I have to advise the would-be or wanna-be whistleblower that these dual goals of complaining about the unlawful activities, reporting them to the authorities, and keeping one's job, you know, that's a real tough one to give anybody any kind of positive guidance about, because you just don't know. And in fact, in reality, What's likely to happen is that once the person does make the disclosures that she or he wants to make, that person's not going to want to work there anymore, because what's likely to happen is that whatever transpires, whatever the regulators do, whatever the court case ends up resulting in, that person's future at the company is largely over.
Well, let me interrupt you just for a second.
That, you know, the supervisors will lie in wait for 5 years.
So how often do you reach this point in your conversation and the whistleblower, the prospective whistleblower, just hangs up
every,
the phone?
Every such conversation. But, you know, there are a lot of reasons that whistleblowers come forward. One is just out of a sense of duty to the general public or duty to customers or clients, or a feeling of pride in the type of work that they do. Somebody who's a person who works as a maintenance person or just an operator in a nuclear power plant who recognizes that the company is, you know, day after day after day pulling one over on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the public. So usually they're not just, by the time they call us, they're not just toying with the idea. They feel like that they're going to have to do something. And so what we do then, we often call GAP and other organizations like GAP, and we try to put together a political campaign that will be in place to support the person if and when they go forward with their allegations. And we try to do it in an organized way so that that we make sure that the employer's on notice of the whistleblower's rights and so on when that takes place, and that there might be congressional representatives or regulators who are lined up to support the person. And we also usually make sure that we have quick access to media coverage in the event that that goes forward. But I think what often happens, and this is kind of a disappointment to the extent that you as a lawyer practicing in this area also have sort of good government goals, is that increasingly many of these cases are easier to resolve quickly, not based on what's going to happen in the Department of Labor, for instance, process, but on the threat that the underlying allegations pose to the company in terms of its investors and shareholders or regulators and so on, like Jason was talking about. So often you can, if the allegations are so damaging that the company is not going to want them to be made public, then the cases can be resolved somewhat quickly, but the company is paying for it not to go forward. So, you know, it costs them a couple of $100,000 to silence a whistleblower and continue to make billions of dollars through the unlawful activities, and it's not very much of an incentive. They'll just keep doing that. It's just the cost of doing business. It's a hard thing when you represent individuals when, in fact, their interest is in, you know, they're not lifelong crusaders. They just got themselves into a fix where they reported something or about to, and they got to get out of there. And you got to help them do that if that's what they need to do and want to do. You can't say, oh, what you should do is, you know, despite all that we've written and other people write about what hard luck you're going to have going forward with your case, you should do that. You're not going to get anything, but society's going to be better off. Yeah. You can't tell them that as a lawyer.
Let me get Jason involved, and I want to throw Jason a curveball, which is I'd like you to answer the question, but also talk some about the ethical dilemmas that lawyers in your situation face when you're advising that client.
Yeah, a few issues here. First, if a client can truly blow the whistle and in a totally anonymous manner, that's great. But I find that's a very rare instance. I find that by the time the prospective client has called me, he or she has already begun to make waves within the company, and I find that the employer will often know who made the call to the EPA or who called the NRC. And then what ultimately happens is that the employer can retaliate against my client. We bring a claim, and they've got all these legal arguments that the people who decided to take an adverse action against my client had no idea he or she blew the whistle, and then I've got that fight. So I find more often than not, if an employee has already begun to blow the whistle, he or she should email the most senior people at the company, the CEO, other senior officers at the company, and make sure that the company can't somehow argue, well, we had no idea who was really blowing the whistle. As to your other question, I find that there are some very complex ethical issues that I deal with almost on a daily basis. Very often, it's a question of whether my client can share certain information both with me and in the course of prosecuting his or her claim. I'll give you some examples. Well, A is an obvious one. I tell all the people I talk to, do not reveal to me any confidential or really any information that was provided by either in-house counsel to the company or outside counsel, because the company owns the both work product and the attorney-client privilege. And if I have that information, it could be an ethical violation, and it obviously could prohibit me from pursuing the claim. But what I'm seeing a lot of that gets a little more complicated is all these employers have these confidentiality policies, and it's gotten to the point where they claim that the air their employees breathe is a trade secret. So very often, and I really only mean that as half a joke, because it's caused a lot of problems for my clients. I have two clients now where the employer has brought a claim against my client for revealing confidential information, and in one instance, the employer is suing my client for defamation because he sent an email to a high-level officer at the Department of Defense blowing the whistle on a contractor's conduct. I find that employers now are becoming more and more heavy-handed in bringing any claim that they could possibly bring against my clients to try to prevent them from pursuing their claim. So I often have to think about that early on. But to get back to these various ethical issues, my clients every once in a while have classified information. I pursue a lot of key TAM actions on behalf of employees, of contractors, of the Department of Defense. I have to be very careful that when I prepare a complaint, for example, that there isn't any classified information, because in my experience, and this hasn't happened to my clients, but I've heard about this, the Department of Defense will be more eager to go after an employee who revealed classified information in the course of trying to expose fraud on the government than actually going after the contractor who is defrauding the government. In one other example, I've had a lot of clients who are security guards at nuclear power plants. And as I'm sure you've seen from articles over the past years, there are major inadequacies in security at nuclear power plants, including a lot of guards who are asleep on the job as they're supposed to protect our country's nuclear plants after 9/11. And I'm very careful with those claims that I don't reveal any confidential information about how our power plants are actually protected. And I usually will try to get the NRC to look at a complaint before it's brought, because once again, the agency is more concerned about protecting classified information than actually going after the various companies who are not complying with NRC rules. I hope that answered.
Yeah, that was great. Let me switch gears again. And this is a question I'd like to direct first to Tom, but I'd like all of you to answer it, so think about your answer. Assume that Barack Obama is the next president of the United States, and you have 1 minute, and I'm going to time it, 1 minute, to tell him one thing that he ought to do to strengthen whistleblower protection without legislation. So put aside changing the statutory framework. 1 minute, what would you tell them?
Well, first, Mr. President, we need your direct leadership. start out with repeated no-nonsense rhetorical mandates so that the bureaucracy knows you're serious about this. Secondly, issue an executive order directing government agencies not to challenge the laws written by Congress in practice in their litigation, and then we won't need new laws. We've passed these three times so far. They're just being ignored. Second, we need leadership through delegation. I suggest appointing Jason Zuckerman to head the Administrative Review Board at the Department of Labor. The Clinton appointees for the Office of Special Counsel at MSPB, and David Vladek at the Department of Justice Office of Legal Counsel to select the judges.
Never take that job.
Further, we need systematic training through the OSC and MSPB so that managers get the message. Finally, we need accountability to create deterrence so that bureaucratic bullies have something to lose. A, visible selection criteria for your appointees that they weren't involved in whistleblower retaliation before. B, discipline for incumbents. Let's start making examples of people for retaliation, not just for committing the truth. And C, make it a critical element in government employees' performance appraisals so that they flunk if they retaliate.
Pretty impressive. A minute and 10 seconds. David,
well,
you're up.
I can't really add to that. No, I really can't. That's a complete list. I mean, I guess all that I would add is just along the rhetorical lines is that if a new administration really wants to protect the rights of whistleblowers and to draw on the tremendous willingness of ordinary working people to come forward and take action in a way that protects the common interest, then the administration will embrace individual whistleblowers, welcome them to, you know, instead of inviting to state dinners all the polluters and warmongers and profiteers and should-be jailbirds who run the corporations in this country. They should be inviting, Obama should be inviting to the White House to dinners of that type and to public meetings and should be, establish a medal even, a White House medal for people who blow the whistle on corruption and wrongdoing. You know, that would go a long way towards setting the tone for the types of protections that people deserve. And I think the point that we're really not, as lawyers and as nonprofits and so on who do this kind of work, talking about protecting the narrow interests of a small group of people we represent. We really are talking about societal interest and protection against, you know, what is increasingly rampant and intrusive domination, I think, of our lives by corporate greed. With increasing technology, that allows them to do it more. So,
okay. Your time is past expired. Sean, you get a minute.
I guess I would broaden it a little bit and ask the president to establish a presidential office on government transparency and openness to bring together whistleblower protection with other government transparency and have a presidential office that really goes around to the agencies and knocks heads about, you know, whether or not they're obeying FACA laws or FOIA laws, whether they're being truly transparent in their decision making, and for the White House itself to lead by example in terms of being more transparent how it's operating with these agencies. I think creating a new system of incentives and enforcements along lines of the two previous of turning this the right way around, where whistleblowers and other people who help uncover problems are actually rewarded or in some way lauded, and those that resist that and are part of the problem somehow face some sort of enforcement performance review system. I think another idea that someone once mentioned to me I thought was a great one is an idea of sort of a Miranda warning statement of rights that the government would have to start posting and reading, but it would be more of a statement of your right to know and your freedom to speak when it comes to government information, that there's an openness here and that every public meeting should start with that and all the offices should have it posted, and something that reinforces to the workers time and time again that there is this transparency right.
Thank you.
It's hard to go forth. It's already probably all of the a number of good ideas have already been mentioned. One thing I was thinking could be added to that is, you know, the Attorney General often writes memos, guidance having to do with certain types of policies like freedom of information policy and so on. Something similar could be done in terms of at least at the federal sector, what protection, statutory protections are. President Obama could also set the policy, of course, at the cabinet level and encourage cabinet officers to enforce these rights within their agencies. Inspector General's offices could be sort of revived in terms of their how seriously they take the rights of whistleblowers. And of course, appointing justices and to the Supreme Court and judges to the federal courts who are likely to be sensitive to the rights of employees, and also various types of employee recognition, as has already been mentioned.
I make three quick points. One is, at the Department of Defense, they need to understand that they are responsible for contractor oversight, not to protect contractors who defraud, really, us. Number two, at the Department of Labor, they need to bring in people who understand why we have those laws, why we protect people who blow the whistle, and it can no longer be an agency that is more concerned with protecting employers than employees, which is what it has become in the past 8 years. And I might add, that did not happen under prior Republican administrations. Number three, at the Department of Justice, we need significant resources to pursue False Claims Act claims. To the best of my knowledge, the government has yet to intervene in one False Claims Act action regarding the war in Iraq. We have been fleeced by contractors of billions and billions of dollars. And there are courageous individuals who brought claims, but the Department of Justice will not help them in pursuing those claims. And I just want to add one more thing, which goes beyond the scope of the question, but I'll keep it brief. Yeah. This is not a partisan issue. I would say the same thing to John McCain. I would say the same thing to Bob Barr. You may not know, but he's actually in this too. And I would say the same thing to Ralph Nader, though I'd also ask him to get out of it so he won't harm the chances of Barack Obama. But I will say, truly, this is being sponsored by a bipartisan organization or a nonpartisan organization. There is tremendous support on the right, as much as on any other side, to allow employees of the government to alert us when our resources are not being used properly. So I wanted to just note that.
That was a welcome addition, because it anticipates my last question, which is, now suppose you get 1 minute, and this time I'm going to hold you to 1 minute, to 1 minute with Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid. And the question they ask you is, look, we've passed all these laws, and every time we pass them, you say, these are good laws. And then you come back a couple of years later and say they're not working. What should we do legislatively that will finally, once and for all, give workers, give both public and private sector employees the whistleblower protections they really deserve? So, Tom, you get 1 minute with the speakers.
Well, the Northwest Passage to having laws that are worth the paper they're written on is genuine due process to enforce the paper rights. Every one of the whistleblower laws that have been passed has had two key problems. While they have a broad mandate for the public benefits of freedom of speech in this context, the people who blow the whistle don't have normal access to court to enforce their rights. They're shunted off to the lowest common denominators of the legal system, which don't have any judicial independence from political pressures, which don't have resources to hear significant complex cases, and routinely rubber stamp retaliation. That's almost their function. These rights are going to continue to be Trojan horses for whistleblowers until they have equal access to court to enforce them. The second thing is they've got to be seamless. They've got to stop being just jam-packed with loopholes. If the information could lawfully expose a betrayal of the public trust, its disclosure should be protected by a free speech shield. If you are an employee who has access to that information, or an individual, it doesn't even have to be an employee. Other countries protect individual citizens who blow the whistle. You should be protected by the free speech right. It shouldn't be dependent on some type of arbitrary legal category. If we eliminate the loopholes and we give people first-class rights to enforce their paper freedoms, then these laws will stop being a bad joke.
Well, I too think that that is really the key that could be achieved legislatively. The fact is, if you can show $75,000 in controversy and diversity among the parties, you can go into federal court and at least try to get a remedy for a lot of things that happen to you. And certainly under federal law, you can. Minor harms and transgressions can be pursued in federal court before a judge and a jury. And under all of the federal whistleblower structures that are set up to adjudicate claims, there really isn't that right. In some situations, there's a right if you're case hangs out long enough in the DOL process or in other processes, then you can go to court. But you don't necessarily have a right to a jury trial. And the issues that have already been decided in the kangaroo court you were in, where you had a right to cross-examine witnesses, will be precluded from your further litigating them in federal court before real judges and real juries, if you could get a jury right. So I think that legislating the right to jury trials, the right to bring lawsuits in federal court, that those rights in themselves, and just eliminating largely the exhaustion of remedies before these hostile agencies, or at any rate doing it like in the race and gender and national origin and religion discrimination context of Title VII, where once you wait before an agency long enough, then you can go to court for a de novo review with a full, with all of the rights that litigants should have, that those would be real keys to protecting the rights of whistleblowers. And it could be done legislatively.
There's not much to add to that. I mean, I think the reality is the courts have botched this time and time again so badly that what we need from the speakers is a commitment, a very public, very vocal commitment, that they're going to keep returning to this time and time again if forced to. I think there's no way to guarantee. I mean, some of these laws sure looked like they were slam dunks, that we were going to get something much better than we wound up getting. And I think the Congress has to say this is vitally important to us, that we're going to revisit this again in 2 years, in 3 years, if necessary, each time, if the courts keep changing the law that we keep setting out. And we need that kind of very vocal commitment. I mean, we certainly need the changes that have already been made, but I think we also need real leadership from Congress that this is a top priority.
Well, it's a novel idea, yes.
Well, and another structural change that I think would be really useful is to end the Federal Circuit's monopoly on developmental law in this area. Because if you allow circuit courts around the country to get at these issues and interpret the statute, you are permitting cross-fertilization and exchanges back and forth as the different circuits consider each other's perspectives. And of course, you have the prospect of Supreme Court review, which is a realistic matter you're generally not going to have now when the Federal Circuit is the only court in town. And that would be a huge improvement. And also, I know the question was focused on federal legislation, but state and county and local government employees around the country make up a far greater percentage of public employees in the federal workforce ultimately. And so I think efforts need to be sort of zeroed in on making improvements in state and local laws to protect whistleblowers. You know, the Supreme Court in Garcetti said, you know, public employees really don't need the First Amendment all that much because there's this powerful network of whistleblower laws around the country that are protecting them. It's sort of like, what? And, you know, Gap actually submitted a whole amicus brief to the Supreme Court to talk about the problems with the statutory protections. But the fact of the matter is it's a patchwork quilt. It's very haphazard as to whether you have any protection at all in terms of state and local laws. And that's an area that probably really needs to be targeted as well as at the federal level.
I don't have that much to add, but being that I'm a member of the bar, I'll talk anyway. No, seriously, to keep it short, I think that the reason we need to improve these laws is where there has been any ambiguity at all, it has been construed against the employee, and the courts have rewritten these laws, have created a series of new loopholes that at the end of the day significantly undermine these laws. And that's why we have to enact comprehensive laws that are proactive, that get rid of all of these loopholes and that help counter the new arguments that will be made to create new loopholes. If I could just add one thing, both myself and other people on the panel, I think, have been rather blunt today about what we've encountered at the Department of Labor. I certainly don't retract anything I said, which applies overall, but I do want to note that there are some very good people at these agencies who've been there a long time, who actually do try to do the right thing, which is very hard to do in the current political environment. But when I complain about what I encounter at the Department of Labor, I don't think it applies to everyone. There really are some people, and they certainly are the exception and not the rule, who try to do the right thing. I just wanted to note that.
Well, thank you for doing that. And that last question was to tee up the final panel of today. I hope you all stay around. We've painted somewhat of a gloomy picture, but the bright news is for the last panel about the legislation that's currently pending. I'd like to ask any member of the audience that has a question to come up to one of the microphones and let's hear it. If you just give us your first name so we don't have to, so we can respond by name, would be helpful.
Well, my first name is Bill and my last name is Hersey, and I'm a federal employee. Actually, I'm a senior scientist at EPA, but all that is for identification purposes only. Okay. Because the hat that I'm wearing now as executive vice president of NTEU Chapter 280, we represent the professionals at EPA headquarters. One of the things I would ask Barack Obama, if I had a minute with him, would be to come to EPA and speak with all of the local labor leaders and identify those middle managers especially, including office directors, who have committed the sins of omission and commission for which whistleblowers have to put their careers at risk, and ask, have those people identified and appropriate disciplinary action taken on those folks. And for Nancy Pelosi and the majority leader in the Senate, I would ask them to amend 7106B of the Civil Service Reform Act to make the discretionary bargaining measures in that provision mandatory, that labor unions be given the right to bargain over means, methods, and technology of doing work, because if we had that right, we could forestall a lot of the problems that end up being whistleblower problems. I also wanted to address the point of why whistleblowers come forward in the federal sector. It's because we raise our right hand and we swear to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign, and as Richard A. Clark so succinctly put it, and domestic. And we believe those people in our chains of command who knowingly violate the law for which require whistleblowers to come forward. Those people are domestic enemies in our point of view. And judges who misinterpret the law are also domestic enemies when they try to rewrite the laws that have been passed by the Congress. That's the constitutional process that we're sworn to defend. Right. That's why we come forward. And I also wanted to say one last thing.
One last thing.
Right. The existence of organized labor in the federal sector is another way to get to what Tom Devine was saying about getting the warnings out. We've had people come to us about problems with pesticide regulations. When they speak through the labor union, they can stay back in the shadows, but we get stuff out in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. When they come to us and talk about we had a problem with carpet making people sick, we got that news out. It didn't require whistleblowing to get that done. Well, there's an issue about the drinking water standards for fluoride. We had, in fact, a guy get fired who was a senior toxicologist, and we nevertheless get the message out through organized labor. That's another mechanism for getting the word out in addition to whistleblower laws. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. Yes.
My name is Sabrina Siegel. I'm an attorney at – can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I'm an attorney at a federal agency that works in foreign affairs. I'll leave it at that. I'm here in my private capacity today. Nothing that I say or the question that I ask reflects the views of the federal government. As a good ethics attorney, I have to get that out. I know that this panel is focusing a lot on domestic issues, but because I work in foreign affairs, I don't want us to forget the non-U.S. citizens that do work for our government overseas. We have a lot of foreign service nationals who are also witnessing problems, abuse of authority, and they are concerned of whistleblowing as much as U.S. citizens are, particularly because in a lot of these developing countries, the best job in town is with the U.S. government. And so not only do they have a fear of disciplinary retaliation, but also being able to provide for their families. So my question is this. No Fear Act requires that we train our federal employees every 2 years in whistleblower and discriminatory retaliation. How, as an attorney, can I, in good conscience, after hearing from the panel this morning, educate and provide guidance to my employees on the No Fear Act and retaliation? When it seems like what I am training them on, not only here in the United States and when I go abroad to train, not only our U.S. citizens, but my agency has felt that it's important that we also educate our Foreign Service nationals on what their procedures are. How can I do this now? Thank you.
Anyone have a short answer to a complicated question?
Well, I think it's not that complicated. You can respect the English language when you're communicating and training with the attorneys. It's not an obligation by government agencies to rewrite and erase the statutes as written by Congress. And through effective training, I think you have the potential to prevent a lot of retaliation. The paper rights are outstanding, and they've been legislated three times. It's just the enforcement process. But we don't really get to that till there's a violation, so folks like you can help prevent us from reaching that stage.
Yes.
My name is Jane Rosen. I am a research scientist with a PhD background in biochemistry, cancer research. I spent 20 years of my career in academic science at a academically funded research facility, mostly funded by NIH. But what happened was they started bringing in a lot of corporate money. So having been in the trenches and having been a whistleblower, I want to bring a new area to the attention of the panel because I think it's basically territory that hasn't been addressed. Lots of corporate money are now pouring into academic laboratories across the country, huge amounts. There used to be a Chinese wall where when the corporate sponsor came into the lab, they did not control the data. The scientist was able to publish their data true to form without corporate influence. Unfortunately, my laboratory and my division that I headed, we took in a lot of money from a very big pharmaceutical company to run studies on a class of drugs that were FDA approved. In my laboratory, with these hands and this brain, I discovered that that class of antibiotics were what we call photocarcinogens, meaning that the average person takes this drug, goes out into the sunlight on a normal day, and is setting themselves up for a high risk for internal squamous cell carcinomas. So having all this data accumulated from 3 or 4 years of studies, I started to publish. I was told that if I published one word about the photocarcinogenicity of these FDA drugs, that at that time was an $8 billion worldwide industry, my division would be closed, I would lose my job, and I would have no future as a scientist. Well, the truth is, I wasn't going to put up with that. I wasn't going to censor data for anybody. Science is a public trust. This was a public health issue. So I set out to publish this data, and P.S., within 2 weeks, my whole division was closed. Every employee that worked for me was walked out the door, and they claimed, and this was the loophole, employment at will, they were downsizing. So after visiting many attorneys, I was told that there was absolutely nothing that could be done, except that I did go to the FDA and I did report this, and I did go home and publish every paper. The bottom line is I never worked again as an academic scientist, but the loss to society is huge because the contributions I could have made, the other scientists that worked for me could have made, there was corruption in terms of misuse of grant money at the time. I went to the NIH granting agencies. They didn't want to deal with it. So the snowball effect is these drugs were then used 30 days, 40 days out with the anthrax scare with the postal workers, putting all these people at risk because this information was not disseminated by FDA. Then you've got the collusion with the grant money, and 120 scientists lost their jobs because the medical director walked off with $5 million worth of core grant money. So the entire institute blew up. And the bottom line is, what can be done with the corporate influence and the money issues in academic science where medicine and health is a public trust?
I think we get the question. I mean, we've all, I think, represented or worked on issues involving the kind of cross the cross-funding of what we had thought was government research but is not. Does anyone have something short to say in response other than we've seen this happen more times than one, and it is a serious problem. We don't have any doubt about it.
I think one of the things my organization would support, and we've talked to other groups, Union of Concerned Scientists, such as if government's involved in any way, there should be a proactive responsibility to publish any and all information, any and all research in a timely fashion. There shouldn't be a pick and choose ability out there that very often, as you're pointing out, comes from that corporate ability. I mean, that's what they do in their private, and now that these are kind of bleeding together, that's also crossing over into what is now a mixture of corporate government research. But you're right, science is a public trust, and there should be a responsibility to be open about it and to be transparent about all findings.
I'll just note real quickly, there are some options under the False Claims Act. If the government is helping to pay for the research and there is some fraud in the research, if the recipient of the government money for the research is not complying with the requirements of the grant or the contract, for example, there are some options that are available under the
Yeah, we went Act. That route, and we were turned down.
Okay. Tom, you get the last word here.
This is more for the third panel on solutions, but this is extremely common problem that Dr. Rosen's describing. The consequences are just huge, and it's one of the most significant cornerstones for both the Whistleblower Protection Act legislation and the corporate whistleblower bills is to protect scientific freedom in just the circumstances she described. And we'll be talking about that more in the third panel.
This gentleman.
My name is Alan Oldberg. I'm an attorney in Washington. I also teach a course called Fiduciaries at Georgetown. and I teach in that course a little bit about whistleblowing law. I've also represented a physician for the last 8 years who was thrown out of the only two hospitals in the rural county where she lives because she's a patient advocate. And for the last 6 months or so, I've been advising a very fine organization called the Semmelweis Society that supports physicians and nurses and med techs who blow the whistle on medical fraud errors and so forth. Now, my question is, my first question is, you've not addressed at all the problem of who carries the appeal to the federal courts, that the fact that there's a pro bono amicus on one side and there's Post and Shell or some enormous experienced organization on the other, that there's an affinity between the judges and the appellate counsel for the defense and so forth. I spent over five years working as a permanent law clerk for the Supreme Court of California, and I always felt it was my job to represent the court and the public and the litigants, because most of the briefs I got were very poor. Now, anyone have any thoughts about how you can clean up the act so you 93% of the appeals are affirmed? What we have at the appellate level is what Ralph Nader calls rich man's law. Now, how do we, and that's exactly what we're talking about today, but we're not talking about how we get there.
All right, well, I think we get your question. Jason, you want to?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd go so far as to say that there are a lot of judges who are in cahoots with corporate America. I'm somewhat concerned by the fact that a lot of the judges who have been appointed under the Bush administration had been partners at large corporate law firms, and that could possibly have some influence on how they view these issues. But I'm probably would not go as far as you. But what I would offer as a concrete suggestion is for people to work closely with organizations like the Government Accountability Project. I've worked with them on a lot of briefs that we submit to circuit courts of appeals all around the U.S. to get our view heard. So the key is to get more people involved in that effort to help out on our side.
I've just gotten the sign that it's time to bring this to a close. I apologize to those of you waiting to questions. The panelists will stay around and would be glad to try to answer whatever questions you have. But I hope you take a minute and join me in thanking these panelists. They did a terrific job.